my happy home to see what I could find out. I left my folk and friends with the aim to clear my mind out. Well, I hit the rowdy road, many kinds I met there. Many stories told me all of the way to get there. Ooh. So on and I go, the seconds tick, the time out. There's so much left to know when I'm on the road to find out.
Welcome to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling on KKRN 88.5 FM. I'm your host, Doug Bennett. Unspun tries to unravel the hype and illusions of corporate media through in-depth interviews with truth-tellers and advocates from around the world. Unspun brings you information you need to deal with the important issues of our time. We are currently streaming live on the internet. Go to kkrn.org and click on the Listen button. Unspun is a call-in show. We invite questions and comments from our listeners. Our number in the studio is 530-337-1885, 530-337-1885. You can also send me email at unspun@kkrn.org. That's U-N-S-P-U-N. You can also follow me on Twitter at DougBennett15. Well, let me introduce our guest. We're lucky to have with us today Paul Beckwith. Paul Beckwith is doing full-time doctoral research on abrupt climate change at the Geography Department at the University of Ottawa in Canada. He is also a part-time professor teaching climatology and meteorology. He is an engineer with a bachelor's degree in engineering physics and a physicist with a master's degree in laser physics. His blog is at http://paulbeckwith, that's B-E-C-K-W-I-T-H. .net. He's taken a close look at the Arctic, researching ice loss, warming oceans, methane releases, and current ocean changes and how they affect climate change. He is currently in Paris at COP21. That's the Conference of Parties. This will be the 21st meeting of the Conference of Parties, the COP climate summits. And so we have people there supposedly attempting to come to some sort of agreement to maybe protect us or come up with solutions to the imminent global warming and climate change that we're going to face here in not too many years. So this year, 196 countries have sent their representatives to Paris to attempt to reach a binding agreement. If the past is any indicator, we have been less than seeing promising outcomes from the COPs for the entire 21 years. So it's imperative that we have global action now. And I want to welcome Professor Paul Beckwith in Paris, COP21. Professor Beckwith, welcome to Unspun, an experiment in truth-telling.
Hello, Doug. How are you?
I'm well, thank you. How about yourself?
Oh, I'm great. Another full day in Paris, you know, at the conference.
Yeah,
very long day.
Yeah, I've been following you on your blog. You put up some interesting stuff and a really interesting interview there that you videoed with, who am I trying to think of? James Hansen.
Yeah. James Hansen, yes.
Yeah. Well, I have a little clip from yesterday's Democracy Now! I'm just going to play it. It'll be a little short one, and then I think we can kind of go from there because his perspective probably reflects the feelings of many of us that have been part of the climate change movement in the world. So let me play this little clip, and then we'll come right back. I want to get your point of view of what's going on there.
All okay, right. Great.
Okay, here it is.
You wrote a piece in The Guardian saying we're at the point now where temperatures are hitting the 1 centigrade mark. You said the UN is on the wrong track with plans to limit global warming to 2 degrees Celsius.
Yeah, absolutely. This is really a total fraud. You know, there's no... we're not going to reduce emissions as long as we let fossil fuels be the cheapest form of energy. There are lots of countries that want to lift their people out of poverty, and of course they should do that. But everybody would be better off if the price of fossil fuels was honest. It should include its cost.
Yeah, Paul, it's a fraud, for a quote from James Hansen. And he said it twice in that interview, so I'm assuming he means it.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
I think he says it every talk he gives these days.
Yeah, your experience there this time, does it indicate anything different, or have you found anything encouraging there?
Well, I think, you know, there's 40,000 people in Paris, and there would have been more, but the French government limited it. You know, I think they've had up to 60,000 people at some of these COPs, and, you know, it's usually in a nice place every, you know, and it's every year. And we've had 20 COPs, and, you know, squat has happened. You know, emissions are still rising faster than ever. So is this going to be lucky 21? I mean, it may be, because there's a lot of things that are different this time around. I mean, the simplest solution is a global fee on carbon. And I really love the fee and dividend concept, where the consumer, you know, all the members of the public get a dividend back. So under this scheme with the fee and dividend, most people in the public actually gain money from the scheme. And it's the heavy fossil fuel users that end up paying. But what is different this year is that there's lots of the financial community is really getting concerned about all of the extreme weather events that we're having and the, you know, all the climate disruption, weather disruption that we're having. So they're starting to, you know, get really concerned themselves. And, you know, I think in terms of I think public will go from not worrying too much about climate change to basically sheer terror about climate change. And then hopefully they go, you know, people settle somewhere in between and we take strong action to do the things that we need to do.
I was surprised this last week because the New York Times actually came out and said some positive things. And amongst those was a poll I think they took with CBS that indicated over 60% of Americans want meaningful action.
Yeah, I mean, that number is just going to increase even more. I mean, the root cause of the disruption, I mean, the target of a 2-degree temperature or 1.5 degrees is not really the right idea, because the temperature is changing differently at different latitudes, and that's the key thing. The Arctic is getting a lot darker. So the reflectivity of the Arctic of sunlight coming in is getting a lot lower, so there's more sunlight being absorbed in the Arctic. And this is happening because the snow is getting darker and there's less of it, and the snow on the land, and also the sea ice is decreasing almost at an exponential rate. So there's more open ocean exposed, and that's dark surfaces. So the Arctic's darkening, so it's absorbing a lot more heat. So it's warming like crazy, you know, parts of the Arctic 5 to 8 times is the warming rate versus the global temperature average, an even higher ratio if you compare it to the equator. So basically the distribution of warming from the sun is changing on the Earth. So what does that mean? Well, because the Arctic's warming so much faster, it decreases the temperature difference between the Arctic and the equator. And that temperature difference is key for weather patterns. So it's key for setting up these jet streams, which are at the height, the altitude that planes fly at. And these jet streams are acting differently. They're moving slower. They're becoming much wavier. And that causes extreme weather events and stuck patterns.
Yeah, another article that was out going along with your studies about the temperatures in the Pacific Ocean and what that means. They also, in the New York Times, had an article by John Schwartz that was entitled "The Pacific Ocean Becomes a Cauldron," which was another kind of shocker. Supposedly.
Yeah, I mean, they're almost using words from some blog post that I've made, you know, like a year ago or 8 months ago. And I you know, one is, in fact, I did a YouTube video. I do lots of YouTube videos, as you'll see from my, you know, if you go to my website. I think I've done almost 100 of them now over the last, say, 4 or 5 years. And I think I called the Pacific Ocean a hot tub or a sauna. I mean, what's different this year over previous years? I mean, we've had jet stream disruption, and the jet stream basically separates the cold dry air in the Arctic from the warmer humid air from the equator. And you know, if it's mostly moving from west to east, it acts as a wall to separate those, and then its location changes with the seasons. But what's happening is it's slowing and it's becoming much wavier, so that you get cold air penetrating down to much lower latitudes and warm air penetrating right up into the Arctic. It's almost topsy-turvy. So the sea ice is key. As the sea ice declines, and we could actually lose the sea ice in the end of the summer melt season in as early as 2020 or sooner, and that will cause cause the Arctic to warm at a much faster rate even compared to what it's been doing. And you know, these extreme weather events that we see, we think they're bad now, you know, wait a few years, and when there's no sea ice, they're going to be far, far worse. So the whole climate system is destabilizing, and that's the key thing, not, you know, trying to meet a target of so many degrees. So I talk about some of the things that I think are absolutely necessary for us to do in order to avoid the worst of situation that's coming down the pipe.
Yeah, you have an excellent website. I've spent a lot of time on there the last week or two. And, of course, you're one of Guy McPherson's favorite references when he talks about runaway climate change and these tipping points as you're talking about. And part of what you were I watched a video blog that you did, and it showed the heating of the oceans going up through the Bering Strait and actually displacing and pushing cold water into the northern Atlantic. Is the possibility there that the conveyor belt that brings all that warm air up into England and New England also, is that a possibility that that's going to stop or go away? Can we have a mini ice age possibly in Europe?
Well, the ocean currents are definitely slowing down. It comes down to the Arctic sea ice. So the Arctic is warming because of the additional absorption of solar energy. So therefore, there's less requirement for heat to move from the equator up to the Arctic. And about a third of that heat is carried in the ocean water, and two-thirds in the atmosphere. So the slowing in the atmosphere is distorting the jet stream, is causing the extreme weather events like torrential rains and things like that we see. And the slowing in the ocean is causing the jet stream to slow down. So what the jet stream has been, or the Gulf Stream in the ocean to slow down. And when it slows down, it travels, it overrides the continental shelf off the east coast of the U.S. So around New York, Maine, all those regions up the coast, you get really, really warm water. And the last few winters, that really, really warm water led to massive snowfalls over the U.S. East Coast, because when you get the winds blowing off the ocean, they pick up all the moisture from that warmer water, which causes more evaporation, and that warmer water is carried over onto the land, and we get massive snow dumps there. So we also get rapidly rising sea level off the east coast of the U.S. In fact, if you go north of New York all the way up, the sea level rose between 2009 and 2010. It rose about 5 inches in 1 year, just because of the warmer water and the Gulf Stream shifting location, pushing the water up. And also, because the Gulf Stream doesn't go as far north, then where it used to go, which was farther north, it no longer goes there. So if you look at the temperature anomaly or difference from what's normal, we're getting a very cold pool of water just south of Greenland, and then south of that cold pool is a warmer than normal pool of water, which is where the new location of where the Gulf Stream is going. So we're seeing the ocean current shifting, just you know, from year to year, and it's So, the whole climate system is changing before our very eyes. I mean, it looks like abrupt climate change to me. And, so when we lose sea ice, we'll have no sea ice in the Arctic, no Arctic Ocean ice at the end of, say September, by 2020. Then within a couple of years, the oceans are clear for 2 or 3 months of the year. And within a decade, they're clear of ice year-round. I mean, that's the way things head. And then we've gone through an abrupt climate change, and we're in a much warmer world. And forget about the 2 degrees or 1.5 degree targets. And the way this is going to affect people is going to completely disrupt the global food supply. That'll be a defining moment, I think, in human history when that happens. Because look at what happened when the food supply was nailed in Syria from drought from 2006 to 2010. Record drought. It drove 1.5 million people who rely on farming. Suddenly couldn't farm. They all moved to the cities, and it was a lot of young males. And so, it caused all the unrest there. So we're going to have this happening on a global scale with this disruption. So I don't think we can just let this happen. I think let the sea ice go.
And the way this plays out here locally in California, of course, we're going through a drought. We have a little rain now. I think people are they don't look back too far. They have a little rain now, so they think maybe we're out of the drought. But I think all indications are, and I think you've said this, there's a very good possibility of a prolonged, decade longer droughts if some of the weather predictions are holding up.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, what's happened in the Pacific is the last 4 years or so, there's been a very warm sort of pool of water sitting off California, and then another one north of that sitting off of Alaska. And what that does is it redirects these jet streams, so it redirects the weather pattern. So we're not getting the storms going over California. It causes that drought. And then this year, of course, the El Nino has kicked in. So now, the heat has been distributed more across the Pacific. So some of those jet streams could now cross California and give it some rain. But once that El Nino passes, and it's actually still strengthening, we'll be back to those sort of drought conditions because the really warm pools of water in the Pacific, they cause the jet stream to go either north or south of it, and in both cases, they're missing California. So, yeah, I mean, I think, it's going to get a lot worse is what I would say, this drought. I mean, this year it's getting a bit of a reprieve from the El Nino, which people were hoping would happen.
What I had noticed, the U.S. Geological Survey puts out information about the Central Valley in California, and they had I'm not sure of the actual time range, but they showed the actual precipitation, whether it was snowfall or just rain, and against that, plotted on the same graph, was a picture of the groundwater elevations. And no matter what happened over that, I think it was about a 20-year period, the last 20 years, it didn't matter because we're pumping the aquifer down faster than it can be replenished no matter what the weather is, which is kind of scary.
Yes, yes it is. And, it's really interesting technology that measures that, and it measures it very accurately. These two satellites are flying in tandem. And the distance between them is measured accurately by a laser, and the laser can measure the any distance change down to like a millionth of a meter type thing, a few microns. And so what happens is as these satellites pass over, say, the glaciers on Greenland, that they're both pulled towards Greenland, so the separation between the satellites decreases, and that distance change between them can be correlated to a mass. And of course, when they go over the California region, because there's less groundwater, the ground subsides a little bit and there's less pull on the satellites. So the satellites end up in a slightly higher orbit and they're further apart. And so that they can measure the amount of loss from the groundwater. And these satellites are so sensitive that, as the season changes, for example, over the deciduous forest in, say, Siberia or northern Canada, the trees start getting leaves on them in the spring, and the satellite can actually detect the increase in mass from this vegetation growth. So it's very, very sensitive. The groundwater is depleting and has been depleting. And we've had these satellites for quite a while, so then we can detect changes over time. I mean, I lived in Thousand Oaks in Southern California for a couple of years. I mean, I loved it. I was working in the aerospace industry for Rockwell, doing laser research. I love the place, but you need water, right? You really need the water. So I think different places are scrambling to build desalination plants and to people are considering building pipelines to carry water. You know, forget about pipelines for carrying, oil or bitumen from the Alberta oil sand, but I mean, we're going to need pipelines to carry water at some point. The way things are going in order to, and also I think, I don't know what the exact numbers are on population, but I hear that, California's population is kind of, in the regions where there's, been this ongoing drought, the populations are actually declining. People are moving to other parts of the state that have more water or to other states. So there is some migration starting to occur already there, because of this drought.
I moved out of the LA area. In fact, my mom lived in Thousand Oaks until she died here recently, and a beautiful area down there, but there's way too many people for the resources. It's really an accident waiting to happen, so a migration out of there would be the smart thing. Instead of taking water from sustainable areas and making them less sustainable and taking it to places like LA and San Diego, which are already a drain on the ecosphere as they are. They're not really livable places, looking forward. So I wouldn't be surprised.
People have to be nimble. They have to, see what's going on, accept what's going on and, react, change their own lives accordingly. So, if I lived in, California and there was this ongoing drought, I mean, if house prices were jacked up a little bit because it had some rain, it's a good time to
good
maybe
time
cash
to
out of the market. I mean, people need water. So, what are government officials going to do in order to supply that water? Because there's some small towns, in inland, and they have to ship in water by truck, right? Water by truck because they just don't have enough. And as bad as the California drought was, the drought in Sao Paulo, South America was even worse. And this is a city of 12 million people, and they basically could only use water, once every couple days, and showers were limited to a minute or two. Almost no time. And the El Nino also changed things this year, so you don't hear too much about that drought this year, but it's just sort of a temporary reprieve, I think.
Yeah, and our social values, or I should say our economic values and the way they're tied in to our social structure. I've had several people on that we've talked about the collapse of civilizations. And Guy McPherson, of course, his point is we're destroying our own habitat.
Ecosystem.
Yeah, it's pretty obvious that we're not sustainable at these populations, and with the foremost logic being Wall Street, which is just a quarterly money grab.
Exactly. Now it was interesting because I said things are different at this COP. Over previous ones. I was in Lima last year. That was my first one. What's different is that yesterday I went to a series of talks. The first one was Mark Carney, who heads the Bank of England, sets the monetary rate, spoke. He's Canadian. He was a big banker there before he got the job in the UK. And he was talking with Michael Bloomberg about the topic was in climate change effects on investment on global money markets and financials and stuff, and And they're starting to recognize that we are in trouble, that, you know, we have to start doing things differently. And they were talking about, you know, carbon fees and tax, carbon taxes. I prefer, you know, nobody likes the word tax, we call it a fee, fee and dividend. I mean, the thing about so they were talking about things like that. And then after that, there was another session on investment, and Tom Steyer gave the introduction. I think he's from California. I mean, most people probably have heard of his name. If not, they could, you know, Google him. But he's a big, he's sort of the antidote to the Koch brothers, if you like. So people are starting to recognize what's happening, but they're always a bit behind the curve, right? I mean, you know, it's because basically, and the whole COP, the whole purpose is to get emissions down to zero, right? I mean, sure, 50% by 2050 or 80% by 20, like each country is coming up with some number. Some countries are going completely off fossil fuels by 2050 or even 2030, they're budging. So we zero emissions, we need to do it on an emergency basis, but I think that's only one leg of a three-legged bar stool, and you need three legs for stability. So that's only one of the legs.
Let me interrupt you, and we'll come back to that three-legged bar stool, because I think that's really important. I want to remind our listeners, you're listening to Unspun, an Experiment in Truth-Telling. I'm Doug Bennett, your host. With us today, live from COP21 in Paris, is Paul Beckwith, engineer, physicist, and climate researcher. We're discussing abrupt climate change and the geopolitics of climate change. Our call-in number is 530-337-1885, 530-337-1885. This is your opportunity to ask Paul questions and find out more about COP21 and his work on abrupt climate change. So 530-337-1885. Yeah, let's come back to that three-legged stool. I saw your video on that, and I thought it was a fairly good analogy to 'cause you have a two-legged stool, it's not too stable.
So exactly.
We know how that works. So maybe go ahead and explain that, because I think it's very important moving forward, one of the most important things you're saying. So what are the elements of this stool that's going to help us maybe survive as a species?
Okay, well, first of all, you know, each leg is equally important, right, to the other leg. Right? I mean, one doesn't dominate, so they're all equally important. So the other two things are, well, the second leg is we need to look at carbon dioxide removal methods, and we need to lower the atmospheric and ocean levels of CO2. So if we can have methods to remove it from the atmosphere, then it will come out of the oceans, and then we'll have to remove more from the atmosphere. But then if we remove it from the atmosphere, it lowers levels of both the ocean and atmosphere, and vice versa. So if we have a method that's easier to take it out of the ocean, then it will also reduce it from the atmosphere. So how do we do this? Well, one of the things is just we stop destroying forests, and we increase the biomass in trees, for example, in boreal forests, or, you know, rainforests and things, and we stop, eliminating these forests or cutting them down or burning them down for palm oil plantations or whatever, as in the case of the rainforest. But also the forests are being stressed. I mean, we have the pine beetle, we have the emerald ash borer. So vast parts of forests are being weakened either by pests like the pestilence. Or if they're in drought regions and they're stressed by water, they're more susceptible to diseases. They're more susceptible to fires and burning. And so this is a problem, with the vegetation on the planet. There's other methods. For example, there's charcoal, or it's called biochar. And if carbon is that is on, say, in the Arctic in permafrost, and when it thaws and melts, then it decomposes and it produces carbon dioxide or methane, depending on whether there's oxygen present or absent. And But what we can do is if we take biomass and we create this biochar, then it's very stable material and it can actually improve the fertility of soil. There's massive amounts of carbon stored in soil, so if we can help nature put a little bit more in soils, then we could have less in the atmosphere and ocean. Or, for example, there's vast areas of the ocean that basically nothing, there's no plankton because there's not enough nutrients. There's no upwelling. So if there's nutrients and some of, there's, in a lot of cases, iron is the limiting nutrient. So if there's iron in the, some parts of the Southern Ocean, then it will stimulate phytoplankton blooms, which will then absorb a lot of CO2. And then as they die, as they sink to the bottom or eat, then that carbon's removed from the atmosphere and ocean. It's stored in a different form. Now, this happens naturally when the wind picks up dust in the Sahara Desert. There's lots of iron in that dust. It's carried across the ocean, deposited, and acts as nutrients for phytoplankton growth. So, again, we're just trying to do things that nature is doing already. So those are a couple of the methods for carbon dioxide removal. There's also about a dozen companies that are looking at creating, ways using technology to remove CO2 from the atmosphere. There's at least a dozen, like I say, startups. So that's the second leg of the stool. So everybody's saying, well, what's the third one? So the third one is even more controversial. I mean, I don't see carbon dioxide removal. Why should it be controversial? We've changed the chemistry of the atmosphere with our emissions. We've changed the chemistry of the oceans. All we're trying to do is change them back to where they were before so we can stabilize the climate. But anyway, the third one is solar radiation management. The other two methods take time. You know, it's going to take us a bit of time to slash the emissions down to zero. Probably not as much time as people think. Imagine the 700 or 800 billion U.S. military budget going to slashing emissions. You know, ramping up renewables under an emergency situation. Looking at methods to capture carbon or to do solar radiation management. You know, if the true enemy is really climate change. These other things are all red herrings. Seriously, I mean, this is on the level. It even exceeds anything that we had to face in World War One, World War Two. I mean, we're talking about the entire ecosystem of the planet changing. You know, we're talking about the Earth perhaps losing the ability to sustain life. You know, we need to be serious about this. So some of the solar radiation management methods would be something as simple as, taking some water out of the North Atlantic, the salt water, running it through nozzles, creating vapor, and that creates low-level marine clouds, which would then cause cooling of the warm water that flows up north, and that could cause some cooling of the Arctic. So if we cooled the Arctic, that would keep the sea ice in place, that would keep the methane and the permafrost on land and in the marine sediments, and that would stop huge amounts of methane coming up. And methane is an enormously powerful greenhouse gas. And even all this fracking, there's huge leakages of natural gas. And natural gas is 90% of natural gas is methane. So all this fracking has, as well as helping to make the U.S. Self-sufficient in energy, it's greatly increasing the methane levels in the atmosphere. You know, we're supposed to have leak rates of 1% or 2% for the natural gas infrastructure, and it's more like, approaching 10%. So if it's 10%, that makes natural gas worse than coal even. You know, and coal, we see coal is dying, right? I mean, coal's basically dying. Coal companies have lost 90-95% of their stock value in the last few years. So what's going to be next? Next will be some of the other fossil fuels like oil and natural gas if we can't get those leak rates down. So everything is changing. And I think seeing Carney and Bloomberg and guys like Tom Steyer and Hansen was talking, and Al Gore was there, of course. I love talking about Al Gore because it drives the right-wing climate denier crowd into hysterics. That makes their heads explode almost. Anyway, I posted some of those, speeches, and, that's the nice thing about COP. I mean, you get to meet anybody and everybody. I mean, just today I was in a session on the Arctic, and Sir David King was one of the speakers, and I had a long chat with him afterwards. And he's the main scientist who gave information to the British government for their climate change policy and so on. So, you know, you do something like that in the UK, and they call you, they make you a saint almost, or, you know, it's like Sir David, the official title. So it's kind of funny. But, but the thing is, let's say the right thing to do from this COP would be put a global price on carbon. So have a global fee. And if you don't need all the countries involved, like if the U.S. and China and India, perhaps Russia, if they did this, then all the other countries would have to come on board. Because if they didn't, and they were exporting carbon-based fossil fuels to the countries that did have the fee, then there would be tariffs. And those tariffs would be collected by the countries that are having the fee and dividend. So it would make sense for every other country, if they wanted to do any trade in energy with the countries that agreed to this fee and dividend, then they would institute their own fee and dividend program so that they would collect the fee in those countries. And, you know, as far as it actually brings people out of poverty, because most, you know, 2/3 of the population they make money off of this plan. I mean, it's great.
And while we know that, and I think Hansen said this too in the interview, when those people get the money, they spend it back into the economy.
Exactly. And the other, but the reason why this wouldn't happen probably in Paris is because those 40,000 policy people and stuff, they'd have no conference to go to next year. Right?
Yeah. Well, yeah, they have Paris this year. Who knows where we can send them to on a vacation next year?
It's in Morocco next year.
Well,
right? They've already determined the location. So it's just like it makes sense for them to, keep doing this. Like, let's negotiate and let's do something. Then we'll have some more negotiations. Like I say, 20 cops and SWAT. You know, is it going to be lucky 21? I mean, there'll be something coming out, and people will be saying, oh, it's a great success. But, you know, look at that CO2 curve. If that curve still goes up at the same rate, if it doesn't start tapering and, you know, flattening and turning down, the rate of rise slows, then nothing's happened. Like, it's just, but we can't, people assume the climate system is linear, you know. They assume if you bend a stick, you assume, and then take the pressure off, the stick straightens out. But you reach a point where suddenly you deform the molecules in the stick and the thing snaps. Or if you're in a canoe and you tip it a little bit, then, you know, it'll right itself. But you go reach a certain point, this tipping point, and you're over and you're in a different state and you can't go back to where you were before. So the danger is, you know, we keep doing squat and we pass this tipping point in climate, and then methane starts coming out big time from the Arctic. You know, the sea ice is gone for long periods of time. And we go up to a much warmer world very quickly. So, how come the UN, all the population projections never, they all assume nothing bad's going to happen and the population's going to go up to 10 billion by 2060 or 2070 and, you know, even as high as 12 billion. I don't think so. I think abrupt climate change is going to take out a lot, you know, it's going to cause huge stress on the global food supply. And, the population is going to start plummeting at some point because we won't have enough food to feed everybody.
Well, let me interrupt you there. We have a caller on the air, and I want to take his call. And this is Russ Wade. Russ, you're on the air.
Yes, sir. I notice most of us are not willing to give up using our vehicles since they support our infrastructures. And we can run about 80% cleaner if we run on ethanol. And the ratio to produce a gallon of ethanol to water is about 10 to 1. And I was wondering what the ratio it is to produce a gallon of gasoline, water to gasoline.
Okay. Paul may know the answer to that.
Yeah, well... The idea of using ethanol or using other alcohols that are plant based is a great idea, except not if if you take corn, for example, and you get the biofuels from something that you would eat, because then you have a choice. When there's a food problem, food shortage, you have a choice. Do you eat or do you drive your car? I think most people would choose to eat. So, but if you can make your alcohol, like ethanol or whatever it is, out of the corn, the husks of the corn and the leaves and the stuff that's wasted, then, or if you can get it from switchgrass, something that you
absolutely
don't eat, then it becomes a very useful way.
Right.
But ultimately, ultimately electric cars can't be really beaten by, with the new, if you get a decent battery, and so you have a decent enough range with electric cars, then you can use the renewable energies that are produced intermittently. Like if it's really windy at night, you can generate a huge amount of power, but everybody's asleep not using that power. So what would you do? Well, you could charge all the car batteries, for example. And then when the demand was really high in the day, your car is still plugged in to the grid, and then power could be taken from car batteries to sort of control the, to meet the higher demands during the day, for example. So there's all these different technologies that we can use. An electric car, it's going to put all the repair shops out of business. Because electric cars, there's a lot fewer moving parts. There's a lot fewer parts than for an internal combustion engine car, and the servicing intervals is much, much longer. So, so you have to really look. Like instead of just you got to really look, because of course all the car repair places would be lobbying against electric cars. Oh, electric cars are no good, right? Well, why? Because they won't have jobs when electric cars come in, because they don't break down like internal combustion engines do. So, you really have to look deeply at how things, because there's always things that you don't expect when you have a massive disruption to tech. But that's what technology does.
The thing to remember is that a car purchase costs a lot of money. So if you look at the existing vehicle infrastructure, and you can run a fuel-injected vehicle on 60 to 70% ethanol with no problem, and your
rates
drop 90%, and it's a very simple fix, and we've already got some excellent ethanol-producing plants here in California. And we are moved towards cellulosic instead of foodstuffs to run those plants. So
we can
pull it off.
Yeah.
Let me jump in. I have a question about the ethanol, and I think it's important.
Yeah.
When you burn alcohol, you're still producing, alcohol is a hydrocarbon. If you're still producing CO2, am I right?
Yeah, you still get some CO2 produced. Yeah, you don't get as much as from burning gasoline. But the idea is that you, if you make the ethanol from organic plant material that would have decomposed and put that CO2 in the atmosphere, right? Then the idea is that you, although you're burning it and putting the CO2 in, the amount that you're using and the amount that you're burning are supposed to be more carbon neutral.
Okay.
But in terms of the ethanol, like in Brazil, they get the alcohol from. They get the ethanol and methanol and different alcohols is the general term. They get them from their sugar cane because it's like got huge amounts of energy. So the cars there are dual, they're dual mode cars. The cars can run on gasoline there or they can run on ethanol. So it depends on the price of sugar as to which they run. Is the price of the ethanol higher or lower than that of gasoline? So the energy content isn't quite as high as it is for gasoline. Like gasoline is a great chemical. You burn this thing, you get huge amounts of energy. But, this is what we've been doing, and now we've changed the chemistry of the atmosphere, so we need to start doing better, right? So it's not such a... technology is always changing, right?
Yeah. Hey, Russ?
Gasoline actually produces a lot of heat, and that does not help your vehicle run. And the octane of ethanol is higher than gasoline, so they put a couple of carcinogenic additives in gasoline to raise the octane. There is more energy, but in gasoline, but it's heat energy, not motive.
Okay. Hey, Russ, I'm going to have to let you go because other people want to try to call in.
Absolutely. So, Thank you.
The alternate technology choices that we have, as you say, you know, hard to beat an electric car.
Yeah. In terms of, I mean, once you have the, you have to build the car. Yeah, and the costs are, higher now than they are for internal combustion engines because we've been building internal combustion engine cars for, over 100 years, right? So we're really good at building them. It's amazing, that you can spend, 10,000, 50,000 and get a car, with all those moving parts and stuff. I mean, because it's come down to economies of scale for manufacturing. So, I mean, we're reaching that for, look at how many fossil fuel power plants for producing electricity have been built in the last number of years. I mean, they're just they can't compete on price with, for example, the natural gas plants or solar farms or huge wind farms. And in Europe, because fuel prices have generally been much higher and have then that's why they've moved a lot faster on renewables than say North America has. It all comes down to, it's not that they're smarter, it's just that if they paid five times the price for a gallon of gasoline there, then they're going to switch to some other form like renewables earlier than we would, for example, pay much less. So, always follow the dollar, follow the money, right? So that's why I was so interested in seeing these investors, these, like, people that were there from, like, a guy from Sweden was in charge of, $10-20 billion investment funds. And, a lot of these funds are really starting to divest out of fossil fuels. I mean, they're worried they're going to be stuck holding things that are lose a lot of value. I mean, why do you think the price of oil is so low? Normally, when it's so low, people burn more, and then that raises the price. But that's not happening this time because there's a lot of demand destruction in fossil fuels. So, is the price going to go a lot higher than 40? Remember, a couple of years ago, it was 150 a barrel. That's when the Liberal government tried to bring in a carbon tax with their green energy plan. Of course, that went over like a lead balloon because oil was already $140, almost $150 a barrel. But we're smart. Like, people are smart, right? Like, there's a lot of smart people, and yet we seem to do so many stupid things collectively, right, as a society. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know if you read the book or know about, but Ralph Nader had a book out a few years back. It was called Only the Super Rich Can Save Us. And just let's see what the date of this is. Just a couple days ago, anyway, there was Tech Billionaires. The title of the title in Wired magazine is Tech Billionaires Team Up to Take on Climate Change. And so we have this supposed leadership, and you said Bloomberg, who's been pretty outspoken, and Carney. So some of these people are indicating maybe the markets can do something. But yet we look at your research, and we look at what one of the tipping points that you've been waving a big red flag about on AMEG, Arctic Methane Emergency Group, I think. So we're already past these tipping points and all this jaw wagging about, the billionaires are going to save us. And, of course, they want a huge return on their investment, right? It's all so conditional, and it doesn't seem to be important enough for our leaders, whether they're economic leaders or political leaders. They don't seem to be ahead of the curve. And maybe you could talk about your research into the methane releases, because they're being cited all over the world, Siberia, the Arctic Ocean. Maybe you could talk about that. I mean, have we gone past one of these tipping points? Or are we already too late? Is it all baked into the cake and we're done?
Well, this is why you need the stool, right? Like I'm saying that we need to do those three things that make up the three legs of this bar stool. And, you know, just trying to solve everything by one leg, which is zeroing fossil fuel emissions, is just not going to be, it's not going to cut it. It's not going to be sufficient. We're going to tip over. And, you know, I think we're in the early stages of abrupt climate change. I think we're getting a complete reorganization of our atmosphere, our jet streams, our oceans, our, you know, ocean currents, where temperature is on the planet, where we, you know, of course, when we get an abrupt change, then areas where you used to grow a certain crop, you know, no longer, it's that area probably is no longer favorable for that crop. I mean, we're seeing animals, talking about migration, you know, human migration is one thing, but where animals are migrating like crazy on our planet. I mean, fish that require a certain temperature range to live in the ocean, they're having to leave their locations and they're having to move closer to the poles where it's cooler. You know, trees migrate, you know, the seeds are carried, you know, areas of vast areas of Siberian permafrost, that areas that were permafrost just 10 years ago are now, forests of, you know, trees that are 6-8 feet high, you know, after 10 years. I mean, nature can change quickly. We're almost, you know, some species are undergoing real time evolution, if you like, to survive. So, but in terms of methane, the reason methane is such a key factor is because the global warming potential is enormous. What I mean by that is one molecule of methane has warms the atmosphere much, much more than one molecule of CO2. If you average it over a 100-year time scale, that ratio is about 34 times more. If it's over 20 years, it's 86 times more. And if it's over a few years, it's 150, 200 times more. So in other words, we get some methane coming up in the Arctic from either the terrestrial permafrost on land or from the permafrost in the marine sediments on the ocean floor on the continental shelf, say, Eastern Siberian Arctic Shelf, and that methane gets in the atmosphere for, you know, of course, it's not going to stay there. It's going to be circulated around, but when it is in the Arctic, it will warm the air in that location 200 times faster than an equivalent amount of CO2. So it's like warming on rocket fuel. And, you know, through the winter, there's areas of the Arctic that are 20 degrees warmer than normal for months at a time during the winter. So there's already effects from methane. But there's vast amounts of methane in the ocean floor. So in Siberia, we're getting these blowholes because the warming is so fast. The gas, you might have methane hydrates that then, which is like ice frozen around methane molecules. When the ice thaws, the methane's released, and the gas expands, so the volume increases about 190 times. You get this compressed gas under the ground, and you get enough of it, and it can blow a crater into the... So we're seeing this in Siberia. We haven't seen it in Alaska yet. It's only a matter of time until we do. But we're also seeing it on the ocean floor, you know, in the Kara Sea. For example, we're seeing these mounds forming on the ocean floor, and the pressure of the methane, which is released because the ocean temperature is higher, so it's thawing the, it's that heat is percolating down through the sediments on the seafloor, and it's melting the hydrates, and the gas is released, and then it boosts, so it's creating these large structures on the ocean floor. So, you know, as the ocean, as the Arctic continues to warm, the risk gets higher and higher that we could get a massive release of methane, which will then, you know, basically warm the planet almost instantly if that happens. And we've seen this happen. Like, there's precedents for all these things, okay? We try to decipher the paleo records, you know, what happened, you know, at the end of the last ice age when the ice was maximum 21,000 years ago and then was thawing. You know, there's periods of time when sea level rose, you know, massive amounts, like 5 meters in 100 years, you know, for several hundred years, like massive rises of sea level. So we expect a nice, comfortable climate system, and because this is how we've developed our civilization. We've been lucky to be in this sweet spot, and we just happen to be pushing the Earth out of this sweet spot. And what I'm saying is, with the three-legged stool approach, if we do all those things, we can hopefully bring our system back into the sweet spot and you know, continue on our way merrily. But I mean, nobody talks about population. right? Like, that's, you know, I mean, consumption and population. You know, population's growing exponentially, and each person is consuming more, and you multiply those two together, and those are the resources that are required. So, I mean, we're doing so many things, you know, I mean, nobody wants to talk about that. Like, is it, okay, so we don't want to talk about maybe having some limit on population, but what the trade-off is letting the population continue to skyrocket up, and then if climate change knocks out a lot of the food supply, then billions of people will suddenly starve to death, right? So is it morally ethical to allow the population to rise to a certain level and then you get a complete crash? Because that will happen with exponential population growth. I mean, we thought it might happen in the 70s. The Club of Rome said we'd run out of food and people would starve. They wrote the limits to growth in 1972. What they got wrong is that we increased food yield. We doubled food yields with technology. Then we doubled them again. Then we doubled them again and doubled them again with grafting and irrigation and stuff. So we ended up increasing food yields, the amount of food we could grow on 1 hectare of land, by like 20, 30 times. So it made the Club of Rome, you know, like they kind of got quiet after that. I mean, they were wrong. They couldn't predict this. This is the first green revolution. There was a Canadian, Norman Borlaug, who went to China, and he alone allowed, you know, prevented massive, like millions upon millions of Chinese from starving because he brought all these methods there. And this was, so I guess the thing is if we keep having new technologies which let us push the population a bit higher, eventually, we're going to run out of luck on this, right?
We will run out of time.
We'll run out of luck on this.
Yeah.
I mean, okay, maybe we can go to vertical farming. I mean, one thing about the food supply that is really good in terms of there is some resilience in the system, because if food prices double or triple or quadruple for most of the world, then right now we waste 30% of food that we grow.
Well, I think we might have lost, Paul Beckwith. That was his phone going off. So we only have another minute here on the program anyway, and so I want to thank Paul Beckwith for being on with us today on Unspun, an Experiment in Truth Telling, engineer, physicist, and climate researcher. And you can go to his website. That's our sign-off music there. So you can go to Paul's website. It's paulbeckwith.net. Has a lot of excellent information there. And you can continue to follow COP21 on Amy Goodman. She's going to be there, I think, for another week maybe. And her program airs here on KKRN at 7 in the morning. So tune in to KKRN for important information on climate change. I want to thank you for listening to Unspun, an Experiment in Truth Telling with us today. Tune again next week. And next up is Peace Talks Radio. So stay tuned.